This program is brought to you by PersonalLifeMedia.com.
Do you know someone who has trouble being close to others? Has a strong need to be right all the time? Expects perfection in themselves and others? Never asks for help even when it's really necessary? This week on Just for Women, we're going to talk with Dr. Janae Weinhold, professional counselor and co-author of Flight from Intimacy, Healing Your Relationship of Counterdependency, The Other Side of Codependency.
It's just as necessary for our country to have limits as it is for a 2 or 3 year old child. But if you don't set limits with them, you know, they just like break everything. They run everywhere. They get into everything. They're rude. They're arrogant. People don't want to be around them. And that's kind of what we become as a culture. It's really easy to understand counterdependency when we have this codependency kind of as the contrast. So on the codependent side, people cling and they, as you said, are needy. But on the counterdependency side, people don't want to have needs and they tend to push others away, especially if there's like it's getting, you know, really too close.
Welcome to Just for Women, Dating, Relationships, and Sex. I'm your host, Elisa Kreitman, back with another powerful expert to help you look and see what might be getting in the way of you achieving all your love, sex, and intimacy dreams. Today on the show, we have Dr. Janae Weinhold, co-founder of the Carolina Institute for Conflict Resolution and Creative Leadership. She's the co-author of Breaking Free from the Codependency Trap, as well as The Flight from Intimacy. She's a professional counselor and former adjunct professor at the University of Colorado. So welcome to Just for Women, Janae.
Well, thank you. I'm really happy. This is the first time I've been on an all-women show, so this is pretty exciting for me.
Yay! Hey. Actually, I have to be honest, a lot of men listen to my show.
Well, I would imagine if they're really wanting to find out what is it that women want, that this is exactly the show they would be tuning into.
Yes, there's a lot of very smart men out there. It's really funny. Okay, so great. Thank you so much for being on Just for Women. I read The Flight from Intimacy, and it felt like a revelation for me to really start to understand what was going on in my relationship when things would come up and I didn't understand why I was reacting to a certain thing or my partner was reacting to something, and your book is so beautiful in how it lays out what might be going on and how to heal it. So I'm very excited to talk to you today.
Well, great, because I think this is one of those ideas whose time has come.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, we know so much about codependency. You know, we've heard about that a lot in our society and any kind of self-help realm where, you know, there's this fear of rejection and not trusting, you know, yourself and being a victim, kind of needy. But you're talking about the flip side of that. You're talking about counterdependency. So talk to us about how that's different from codependency.
It's really easy to understand counterdependency when we have this codependency kind of as the contrast. So on the codependent side, people cling and they, as you said, are needy. But on the counterdependency side, people don't want to have needs and they tend to push others away, especially if there's like it's getting, you know, really too close, where the codependent person might be, you know, acting more weak and vulnerable. Those on the other side with counter-dependency issues, they tend to act very strong and vulnerable, and they want to put on a good front. They have this kind of veneer that says, I'm strong, my life is working really great, I have this good job, I'm driving the right car, I have a trophy partner. And it's really kind of like the American persona that everything is going great. And on the counter-dependent side, these people tend to be more self-centered. And they're addicted to activities that are what we would call uppers versus being kind of other-centered and addicted to people when they're codependent. So the kind of addictions that we see with counter-dependency are so different. Except in our culture, they're not really recognized as addictions or recognized as normal. That's what we do in our culture.
Isn't that funny? It really is. And when I started to read your book, I looked at some of the behaviors of counter-dependency, and I couldn't believe it because there I was, you know, some of the things that I do in my life. You know, you really think it's normal, like having anxiety or being distracted. And I started to talk to my friends about this, and they're like, oh, I'm such a procrastinator. And we don't really realize that these are things that are in our mind that are taking us away from being effective, powerful, completely empowered people in our lives. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about what are some of the counter-dependent behaviors. I mean, you said, you know, the type of person, the characteristics, they want to be strong and put up a good front, but really there's a lot happening underneath. So what's going on underneath this sort of bravado type facade that's happening in counter-dependent, with counter-dependent people, say?
Well, mostly what's going on underneath this veneer is that people are afraid and they've been wounded. What they're really afraid of is getting too close, and that getting too close brings up memories of times when they were abandoned or they were abused or they were used in some way. So it's really a trauma reaction. And it's been so helpful for me to see people doing, you know, codependent kinds of things. And rather than judging them and having some kind of belief, you know, there's something wrong with them, what I tend to do is look at what's right about their behavior. So it's really a reaction against something. But I don't think most people are very conscious of that. It's like whatever they're afraid of is also unconscious. So this is just a coping mechanism for helping people stay safe.
So something happened in their childhood, and you talk about developmental traumas as the key to understanding our behavior as adults. So talk to us about what is a developmental trauma?
Well, there's really like two sides to the coin. First, there's developmental trauma during infancy, and this would be the period of development when people are experiencing natural codependency. During this time, the child is learning to bond, particularly with the mother, and there is this experience of deep communion, of resonance, of emotional synchrony, of that mother being really tuned in to everything the child is feeling and needing, and being able to meet those needs in a timely and loving way. Hardly any of us got that. So when we have trauma during that period of development, what we tend to do is we are trying to recreate that symbiotic experience that we had with our mothers with a partner. And we want our partners to be this perfect parent, to be there, always available, to always meet our needs and to mind read, you know, and know exactly what it is we're thinking. So that's one half of the developmental trauma. But in the counter-dependency stage, it's quite different. Because during this stage, the child is going through a process of becoming separate from the mother. It's the whole individuation process that Carl Jung talked about. And in this stage, the child has to figure out how to operate with an autonomous self, how to function independently, and how to go out in the world on this internal power. And the way that our parents manage our efforts to be separate has a lot to do with the kind of trauma that we experience and the kind of behaviors that we have as adults in relationships. So if, for example, our mothers are, you know, like my mother, she really didn't want me to leave the house. We lived out on a little farm, And I loved being outside where all the men and the tractors were. And she was always pulling me back inside. So I had these messages that said, you can't be separate. The other kinds of things that parents do that interfere with this separation process is they punish. They use either emotional punishment or physical punishment to keep the child from wandering out too far. Or sometimes they give the child double messages that says you can go out, but you can't go too far. Or you can go out, but you can't do it differently, or you can't think differently, or you can't become some person that I would disapprove of. Well, that keeps us all stuck, you know, in these kind of stages where we go back and forth between being codependent and counterdependent. It's like some kind of curse, I think, that we're all struggling with in our evolution.
This is why so many people are unhappy and suffering. You know, it's like we're born and all of these messages start happening. It's a wonder we can even have intimacy and relationships now, which is why I love your book so much.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of really wounded people, but they don't know that early wounds that are causing so much of the suffering.
So let's talk about that. So here we are, we're an adult. You're saying that during infancy, there's these really specific things that need to happen as children. Most of us didn't get them. And, you know, I'm sure our parents, you know, they were doing the best they could. They don't even understand that what they were doing, how they were trying to pull us into their world was actually sort of messing up our natural evolution and growth process. So here we are, we have some of these issues, you know, we get easily bored, we don't accept help from other people, we're striving for perfection, and we think that's normal. How do we start to develop new behaviors or heal from these counterdependent behaviors that are really squelching us from getting what we want?
Well, the first step that seems to work most effectively is just connecting the dots. And I hear that's what you've done. You've been able to connect the dots between your behavior in present time, your struggles in your relationships, with things that happened in your childhood. And when people can connect those dots, that often is like, you know, the light bulb going off in their brain. All of a sudden, everything that they've done and all the struggles they've had with partnerships, with their children, you know, with colleagues, it all starts to fall in place. Because it's like, aha, now I know what was going on. So that part is really important. And people want to know, how can I heal? Okay, I've got it. All right, it happened to me. I have this trauma now. What do I do about it? I think people want to, we just don't have time to like sit and read 500 books on the topic. We really want to know, what can we do about it in here and now? And the thing that Barry and I have found to be the most effective is that we find people that are willing to work on it. Now, if we can find a really great partner like I found and a husband, that's wonderful. But other people don't. They work it out with their pets. They work it out with their brothers and sisters. They work it out with lifelong friends. They find even a colleague at work, you know, where they spend more time actually than they do at home. And they decide they're going to close the exits and they're going to work on the conflicts that come up.
Is that really, I mean, I hear what you're saying, but is that really wise? Because some of the things that we might not even be aware of in our upbringing that are affecting our ability to be intimate and fully empowered adults, is it wise to do that with friends and family? The places, especially with family, where a lot of the trauma happened? Or do we really need some sort of therapist or professional?
I think it could, both and is really the ideal combination. Uh-huh. I have a sister that's 11 months younger than me, and we got divorced within about 5 or 6 years of each other, and she now lives close to me, and we've just worked a lot on our stuff. And it's kind of a double-edged sword, because on one hand, we really understand what happened to each other. On the other hand, we also can trigger each other. So we take those issues and we work on them. We have women's groups where we work on them, but Barry and I have actually used a combination of relationship work and therapy work. And when things get too much or get, you know, we can't really get through them, we get stuck, then having that outside person to help us is invaluable. But, you know, when you talk about colleagues, these are like really special people. They're not casual friends. That's not really a good idea. But someone that we trust, someone who wants to become as conscious about all this as we do. And, you know, they're someone who would really commit to staying together because you're already good friends. So it's like just taking that friendship or that relationship another step.
So how would that look? Say you and I, we're married and something comes up. I want to give my listeners an example of a great way as a woman. Say I'm the woman and you're my husband, and I want to approach you with something that's come up that I'm noticing about myself. How would I even approach that?
Well, the first thing that I do is to notice that I'm having an overreaction about something. So let's say you made a 25-cent comment, and I had a 50-cent reaction to it. So maybe you said something about, some project that we worked on together, and you made some comment that hurt me. And rather than kind of brushing it over, I would say, what you said I know was really true, but the way that you said it was hurtful. Is the way that you could say that to me without it having being maybe in a more objective way, without the kind of critical tone or the judgmental tone? And so maybe Barry would say, well, I don't know what that would sound like. I thought I was being non-judgmental and not. And so I would say,
here we go.
This is pretty difficult. So I would say, well, because really our partners are very teachable if we don't expect them to mind read and figure out exactly what to say and how to say it. So I might say, well, if you could start out by saying, okay, this part of what you said or this part of what you did was really effective, but I had a question. I wasn't sure about this part. You said it in a certain way. Did you mean something else, or did I misinterpret it? So there's more of an air or attitude of curiosity, of inquiring, and through that I'm able to say, oh, well, gosh, maybe that really, I could see why you'd say that because it did come out, kind of sideways, and maybe it wasn't the most effective way to have stated it. So we kind of go back and forth in looking at it in an objective way. And then one of the things that we really try to do is to use non-judgmental language. So if Barry would say, well, when you spoke to that student in that kind of critical tone of voice, oh, I got this feeling in my stomach because I thought, well, that student's going to go away from here hurt. Rather than saying to me in a more objective way, non-critical way, when you spoke to the student and you raised your voice a little bit and there was a little bit of edge of emotion with it, I was wondering if there was something that was going on with you. Did that person say something that triggered you, or what were you feeling when that happened? More of trying to learn about me rather than worrying about, this would be the counter-dependent perspective. Gosh, I'm worried about what that student thinks. I'll go home and they'll tell all these people that we did a bad job, and it's that, we have projected something less than the perfect veneer here.
Yeah, exactly. And I could see how that really does take a lot of practice. It takes a lot of being in the moment and noticing what's going on, noticing your feelings, noticing my own feelings, and getting into that place of not being so critical. And again, yeah, I love what you said about how we can, I think you said, train our partners. In relationship, it is the number one place where we want to have intimacy. We want things to go well. We want love, connection, support, all of these things. And yet we as women, it's so important for us to steer how that's going to go. And so I really like that, taking a non-judgmental, non-critical, really just noticing, hey, I noticed this and I'm curious about that. So I think that's really important to cover. Okay, so you talk about developmental traumas and how they're really these things that happen all over the place in our childhood. We don't really realize them. And some of the ways that we can start to notice them is to catch ourselves when we notice we're overreacting, be curious, things of that nature. Talk to us about what are some of the developmental traumas that happen that we might not even be aware of? Or what are some of the signs in our normal life, like things that we think are normal, but you're saying, actually, check that out. Go deeper.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that I watch for that's related to this overreaction is the common reactions to trauma are to want to run away. That's the flight from intimacy. The other one is the urge to fight, you know, that feeling of kind of this steam rising up in me, and I'm ready to kind of come back at people to, you know, to defend myself, to make the other person wrong. So I have this big head of steam, and that's quite different than my urge to, you know, just run out the door. And then there's another reaction that's very common, and that's the freeze reaction. That's the place where it's like I lose my voice, I kind of collapse down inside myself, and the other person can yell or they can say critical things, and it's like I just stand there and take it.
Mm-hmm.
Have the ability to say or do anything, and so I kind of like retreat down inside myself. So if I see myself doing any of those three things, then I know I'm having a post-traumatic reaction, that there is something going on besides this event in the moment, that I'm touching into some of these old traumas from the past, and I'm in this process of regressing, that I'm going back, like re-experiencing or remembering or reenacting something from the past. And I've done this a lot with Barry. My first husband, he was more like my father, but I've worked on a lot of my traumas with my mother with Barry, and it's so interesting because when he watches sports, he has a great ability, it's great most of the time anyway, he has this great ability to focus. I mean, he can just tighten his laser in, so he can really, really work on something. Well, when he watches sports, he's got that laser turned down, so it's about, you know, an inch wide. And I can be moving around him, I can talk to him, you know, and I have all this activity, and he doesn't see any of it or hear any of it. And what that reminds me of is my mother, who had this kind of distant, faraway look in her eyes. She was a dissociative person. And so I'm triggered right back into being this little girl who's saying, Mom, 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 are you there? Don't go away. So we've worked a lot on that one. And he's been probably my greatest person to help me clear that trauma of having this kind of absent mother. Even though she was physically present, she was emotionally absent, and I could always see it in her eyes. So that's just one example of all the kinds of things that we've healed.
Interesting. Emotionally absent but physically present. I think that a lot of the time, you know, you wouldn't think that's abusive because it's not physical or sexual, but you talk a lot about emotionally absent parents and the big effect that has on us. And you just gave a really great example of that kind of thing. And so as we as women are going about our life, you know, it's time, and why your book is so timely, because maybe we weren't physically or sexually abused, but there's that emotional component of our parents doing these things that we don't even realize have such a big effect on our ability to be intimate. So we're going to take a break, Janae, and when we come back, I want to talk to you more about how we can talk and look at how counter-dependency is showing up in our society as a whole.
Okay, great.
Yeah, we're going to take a break. I'm Elisa Kreitman, your host of Just for Women, Dating, Relationships, and Sex. I'm speaking with Dr. Janae Weinhold, and we're talking about counter-dependency, how to identify it, how to get some freedom from it, and we'll be right back.
Listen to Beauty Now, the intersection of cosmetic surgery, longevity, and biomedical innovation for confident decisions in preventative aging on personallifemedia.com.
Welcome back to Just for Women, Dating, Relationships, and Sex. I'm your host, Elisa Kreitman. We're speaking with Dr. Janae Weinhold, professional counselor and co-author of Flight from Intimacy. Before the break, we were talking about codependency, what it is, how we can detect it, and how we can heal from it. And now I want to talk with you, Janae, about, you mentioned in your book that we can look at our society anxiety as counterdependent. What do you mean by that?
Well, when a whole group of people do something together, it becomes a cultural issue. I mean, yes, we have counterdependence, you know, personal and how it plays out in the relationships and how it plays out in the family. But the truth is, our families sit inside a culture, and our whole country was founded by people who, you know, wanted to get away from something. I mean, people mostly moved here from Western Europe, and they came here because they were dissatisfied with some kind of oppression. So it was just so interesting to look at how all these people then, they settled along the East Coast, and when the neighbor's smokestack got too close, you know, they packed up and they kept moving west and west, and when you couldn't go any further west, then they went to Alaska and they went to Hawaii. So there has been, I think, a cultural tradition of trying to get away from something, trying to be free of something. And that's kind of at the heart of being, I think, counterdependent at a cultural level. So we have this background, but we also have this tradition of somehow Americans kind of appointed them, or maybe I should say anointed themselves, as being the special people on the planet. And right now we're, I don't know, about 8% of the world's population, but we're using close to now 30% of the world's resources. And so this whole picture of us as ugly Americans is being seen around the world, that most of the problems on the planet aren't with countries that are developing. It's with Americans who become hogs. We're hogs of all the world's resources, and that's really the whole counterdependency thing, is it's about entitlement.
Mm. And also, it's really funny. I get what you're saying. You know, earlier you were talking about the self-centered person putting on a good front, very strong, and has these uppers activities, which we can talk a little bit more about. But yeah, we can really look at America as that as well. We think we're so strong and we can go into any country and we're going to transform them and show them the light and bring them democracy. But really, we are probably the most insecure, greedy, you know,
needy,
unsettled people.
Right.
And so, okay, so I can start to see now, well, so how do we as a country, as a society, I guess how you heal that is by taking the individuals and having the individuals heal, yeah?
Well, if individuals don't want to heal, then we get it as a group. And so it's just interesting to think about America. I mean, Barry and I have lived in Europe twice, once in Eastern Europe and once in Central Europe and once in Western Europe. And people over there see us as sort of adolescent, you know, that we haven't quite grown up as a culture. So we've looked at, Barry and I have, you know, what things are two-year-olds working on? Well, they're working on having their little egos subdued, because two-year-olds tend to be a little bit grandiose. They're also entitled, and they have this feeling, you know, I'm special and somebody owes me something, and I actually deserve more than my share because I'm so special. There's also this sense of omnipotence that two-year-olds have. You know, this is power without limits and kind of exaggerated confidence. And then there's, if you've ever watched a child go from walking to running, there is this euphoria, this kind of frantic, manic behavior, trying to do a lot of things at once, this fast pace of life, and nobody wants to sleep. So if we don't complete these tasks in our two-year-old stage, and we don't finish them when we are in that, like, 12 to 16, which is kind of a replay, then we just grow up to be a culture that says, we're number one. We're entitled to more than our share. You can't set limits on me. I can go anywhere. I can start a war with anybody. I can take their natural resources, and nobody can stop me. And so it's sort of like I'm feeling. We have a lot of friends who live out of this country, and they are saying, you know, y'all are about to get your comeback. And I'm like, what do you mean? And they're like, well, the world's getting a little upset that you guys are ruining the whole planet. So I think there is some kind of quiet agreement among countries that says, well, maybe you all need to have a little economic recession. Maybe you need something to show you that you can't continue to have more than your share.
Yeah, it's interesting. The parent becomes other countries and even the planet itself.
Our planet, yes.
Something has to be the parent there. really interesting. I love how you've expanded out this clearly things that go on with individuals, but really looked at our culture as a whole and what's going on. And it really helps to not be so upset and crazed by what's going on, you know, because I know a lot of people, they just get so upset by what's going on with politics and around the world. But when you look at it from your point of view, it actually makes sense.
It's just as necessary for our country to have limits as it is for a 2 or 3 year old child. But if you don't set limits with them, you know, they just like break everything. They run everywhere. They get into everything. They're rude. They're arrogant. People don't want to be around them. And that's kind of what we become as a culture. And I don't think most Americans are very aware of that, because how many of them are really aware of their unresolved issues around, you know, their own codependent stage of development. But I do think that our government leaders they're like bigger than life examples of us. And our job is to look at them and say, oh no, I see myself in George Bush. How am I like George Bush? How am I like Dick Cheney? How am I like Hillary Clinton? How am I like Barack Obama? How am I like John McCain? These are all people who are sort of caricatures of us at a personal level, and they are shining the mirror in our faces now really big.
Wow, that's a great point. I never really thought about that. And that's what we do in a relationship. We want to point our finger and say, you're bad, you're wrong. And we hardly take the time to say, wow, how am I like that?
Right, and I think, you know, I don't know about you, but I didn't really get to that place until I was like in my 40s, because in my first relationship, my first marriage and other relationships that I had, I did a lot of thinking that I was the right one and everybody else was the wrong. But, you know, after you've had several relationships and they end up in the same way, or at least they end up feeling the same way, the outcome is so similar, then it's like, you know, some of this must be about me. And that turning point.
Yeah, that happened to me last year. I was in this relationship and it ended, and I'm like, you know what? I'm getting older. I actually have to address this now. You know, if I want to get married and have children, which I do, it's like I really had to stop and take a look at what was going on. What were the patterns? What was I missing about myself and men that really, you know, the light wasn't coming on.
Right.
Which is why I'm so glad that I have this show and that I can share with women my journey as well to waking up to being an empowered woman, having a fantastic relationship with amazing sex and amazing intimacy, and finding books like yours and information like yours that really start to put the puzzle pieces together.
Well, I think women are actually the pioneers in this field, so it's great that you have a show where you encourage women to do this, because I don't think relationship is men's like primary occupation. They're really kind of wired to be the doers, and women are more wired to do the relationship thing. So that whole idea of having to teach our partners how to do it and assuming that it's not going to come natural to them, that's been a really important piece for me.
Yeah, so, for sure.
I also want to say, and I think this has been one of my biggest ahas in being in a long-term relationship, is I tried so much to put all my unresolved issues with my mother on the Barry. And even though he's a really kind and has a lot of strong feminine qualities, I really found that it took healing all this with women. So I have myself a women's group. I have myself connected to other women. And I don't try to make my husband into my mother, even though he might in some ways be able to do that. It just has never worked. And that was probably one of the big things that caused my first marriage to fail, is I had a huge expectation on my not very emotionally available husband to, you know, to be my mother, and he just couldn't.
Yeah, well, that's very interesting that you say that, because I was researching the divorce rate in America, and this woman, Jennifer Baker of the Forest Institute of Professional Psychology in Springfield, Missouri, she said that the divorce rate in America for first marriages is 50%. And check this out. She said that the divorce rate for second marriages is 67%, and the divorce rate for third marriages is 74%. So clearly, right, half of the marriages, first marriages that are happening are failing 50%, and then second and third marriages, the rate's even higher. What would you say is going on with that? I would think people would get smarter as they have more and more marriages, but maybe we're just more and more unconscious.
Well, I think one of the real big problems, Elisa, is that people don't have good tools. I think these are a lot of really sincere people with good intentions who want to have a happy relationship. And that's why in our books when we write, the first part is about the problem, but the last part is really about helping people connect the dots and giving them things where they can personalize the information. And they, when they don't have the skills, they get into the relationship and they start to feel like failures. So every time they enter a new relationship, I think there's also a lack of confidence, because if they're not going to relationship school and they're not really finding out what is it that makes a relationship work other than trial and error, then they just get disappointed, and then they get caught up, I think, in this whole cultural attitude that we have that is what I call the throwaway mentality. So, you know, if you know, your car doesn't work, you get another one, and if you don't like your house, you buy another one and throw away all those clothes, those are last year's clothes. And so we just get into throwaway relationship and go get another one. But I think underneath that is really just a lot of unskilled behavior, and our books are really designed to help people develop some of those skills, but people really have to want to do the work. And I think that's the critical thing, that eventually, and I know this is where Barry and I got to, is that we decided we're going to close the exits and we're going to do whatever it took to make this work, that this wasn't going to be a throwaway. And so we spent a lot of time kind of experimenting and doing our own trial and error, but the outcome always was that we were going to make it work and we were going to keep transforming ourselves and the relationship as many times as we had to in order to get to that.
Yeah, because, you know, as you say, when you're in an intimate relationship, that's when all these unresolved issues come up. And a committed relationship is the perfect place to start working through some of this stuff. But really, it takes two, and it takes that commitment. I'm not going to walk away. I'm not going to run away. We're going to work on this stuff together, because we understand that is the design of relationship.
Yes, and I think what it requires in order to do this in a committed relationship is something that Barry and I did. We just redefined intimacy. Most of the programming that we had, you know, from the movies of the 50s and the 60s and the 70s was always this idea that intimacy meant that you were feeling close, that you were having sort of these euphoric, expansive experiences, you were always in the flow, and being able to sustain that was what intimacy was about. Well, heck, nobody can really sustain it if we have all this trauma that we're dragging around with us. So we decided that we would just define everything that we were doing as intimacy. And there are moments where we have these euphoric, expansive experiences, and we're able to sustain them for longer and longer periods. But when some unresolved trauma comes up, it like throws us down into the depths. And it used to cause separation, but now what we do is we just dive down into that well, and we have learned how to share our wounds. And when we are able to help each other do some healing work, we experience not that expansive kind of intimacy, but what we call depth intimacy. And that's a kind of sharing where we're really present for each other in a way that nobody else was able to do while we were growing up. And in that moment, we have this feeling of our souls touching, and it is so satisfying. And the more that we've been able to do that, the more that when we have a conflict, we don't get afraid, because we start to trust that we can go down into that well and we can go through another round of healing work and find that deep heart connection, and then it moves us into kind of like some new expansive experience. It's sort of like riding a roller coaster, except the highs and the lows have gotten not so high and not so low. It's more just a kind of a wave and the ebb and flow.
Yeah, it sounds like if we can be that vulnerable and intimate with each other and heal those wounds, of course it would smooth out. Of course it would go away. It's just a matter of taking the time and offering the love that is required, not only for ourselves, but for our partners too. It's like this whole process, and like, yeah, getting into a relationship is going to take all that. I really like that.
One of the things that is really critical about this, because it's a choice, and people are saying, ooh, who wants to go in and feel all that old stuff, and who wants to deal with that trauma? And at some point, I think people reach this threshold where they recognize, you know what? If I don't do it, I'm going to suffer. And if I do it, there is the hope at least of not suffering as much. So, I mean, why wouldn't we want to do it other than, I mean, we just spend all of our life being lonely and separate and yearning and kind of unsatisfied.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, it's like some of the things you talked about, the characteristics of counterdependence. Counterdependency is that you're strong and you're putting on this good front, but deep inside you're unsatisfied. And you'd actually have to stop and make it okay to say, you know what? I think there's some trauma here. I think there's something that I missed as a child that I need, which would like break up the whole codependent counterdependency thing.
And the way that you're saying it, Elisa, it helps, is exactly what the way to help people say, oh, I'm not crazy, I'm not stupid, I'm not broken, I had some trauma. Oh, it's trauma. There's no judgment about trauma. Trauma isn't something that, you know, there's any blame for. It just happened.
Yeah, it was definitely in my culture growing up and definitely in my family, you know, there was something wrong with you if you had a problem. You know, we were supposed to be these like little warriors that nothing ever bothered us and, you know, not to have any emotions. And, you know, I see this now as an adult trying to have an intimate relationship. And that's why your book helps so much, because I started to see things that I thought were just normal behaviors and how they interrupted my ability to actually be loving and kind and present and calm. And like, you know, here I am, this empowered woman, and then thinking that all these behaviors that actually came from a childhood trauma were normal behavior. And so mm-hmm. This is why it's so important for us to read this book, in particular, The Flight from Intimacy, to start to understand, you know, maybe some of those behaviors aren't the most healthy. You know, we have to wrap up, but before we go, I want to ask you about you talk about counterdependent versus interdependent sex. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Well, the counterdependent version of sex is really what I call fast sex, and it may have to do more with the quantity rather than the quality. It's not really about making a connection. It's so interesting because my son referred to this as he called it sport sex.
Well, there's another term for that, but we won't say it.
Yeah. Well, all right. That was the term that he used. So when we talk, and it's where a lot of people are because they just don't trust themselves to have an intimate connection, that if they do, they're going to get hurt. So on the interdependent side, it's much more about being able to communicate about what we need in a sexual way and an emotional way. And I have found that when I'm feeling really emotionally connected to Barry, that we have a much better sexual connection. And if we try to have a sexual connection without that feeling of kind of, you know, that shared experience of where we are, kind of being on the same page, that it just doesn't have the same kind of quality to it. There's something shallow about it. So in some ways, the whole thing about being able to do this deep healing work where we have the soul connection, in some ways has been as much, maybe sometimes even more satisfying than having a really good sexual experience. It's that deep emotional connection that I think women want. And I think men want it too, but they just have trouble knowing how to get there. So if women can be more vulnerable and they can be more compassionate with the guys that they're with and know that a lot of them are just plain struggling, it's like they're learning a foreign language, and not have such high expectations, that women are more likely to get what they're looking for.
That's interesting. You echo something that we've heard a lot with experts who talk about men and how it might occur to women that men are being insensitive and checked out on purpose, and they're doing things on purpose. But really, what we're starting to see and understand and realize is that men are really just trying to figure it out themselves. They're nervous. They get freaked out. Here they are trying to approach this woman, try to approach having this amazing sexual experience. They're not geared toward being in their body or talking about their feelings. So how's that going to happen? How that is going to happen is when the woman starts to steer a little bit and she can start to talk and understand what's going on over there with the man. So if we were going to have, it sounds like what you're saying is we have to relearn how to have sex and to go a little deeper into the quality. So what would you recommend for someone, women who are trying to have more quality?
Well, I think the important thing is to help separate nurturing from actually having sexual intercourse. But that's the big thing that men don't know how to do. They don't know what nurturing means. They don't know what cuddling means. They learn how to have sex by masturbating. And so the whole idea of putting another person into their sexual experience, if there's a step in there that they miss, that girls seem to get. Girls get more nurturing from their mothers, but most boys don't get much nurturing, so women have to train them. They have to learn how to give them the nurturing that the women really want, and they have to teach them. This is what it feels like. And I think they're very teachable because inside that man is a little uncuddled boy.
That's so cute.
Yeah.
That's so cute. It's interesting. I just did a weekend workshop with David Data. Do you know him?
I sure do.
Yeah, he's doing some amazing things, doing exactly what you're saying, teaching people how to have sex that's like hours long and includes breathing and looking into each other's eyes and facing each other, looking at each other, being heart connected. And it's a lot of what you're saying, you know, and facing that fear of being that conscious and that connected to someone and being sexual.
Right, and I think in order for men to do that, most of them have to cross over some trauma. Mostly it's the trauma of either not getting what they wanted or getting something, but it was the wrong kind and delivered in a hurtful way. I think men have a lot more trauma than we ever really recognize.
Really?
Absolutely.
And we probably don't hear about it because men aren't geared toward having men's groups necessarily and talking about these traumas, whereas women, I mean, that's kind of ingrained in us to do that kind of thing. Do you think in the coming years we're going to hear a lot more from men about healing trauma?
I do, and I also feel a lot of hope because I see the younger men have gotten much more involved in parenting their children, and so they're learning about that nurturing experience through their parenting. And women used to be the primary, you know, people involved in nurturing children. But I just see so many young men who are so physically and emotionally present with their children. And I just feel a lot of hope as a result of that. And I think even grandparents are watching, you know, their grandchildren be parented differently by their own children. And so we see, I think, evolution at work. We see the young children who are coming in, and they are so emotionally available, and their parents are reacting to that. And through that, I think a lot of grandparents are being transformed, that the grandpas in particular are finally learning what it's like to have that deep, nurturing connection with the child and then maybe with their wives.
Yay! Janae, you're fantastic. We have to wrap up here. So tell us how we can find you and your husband, Barry, and all that you're up to.
We have a website. It's www.weinholds.org, weinholds.org. We're located near Asheville, North Carolina. We're in the process of revising our website. We'll have a lot of the new podcasts, the interviews that people have. We're also putting up a YouTube channel. So we have 6 hours of television shows that are now on, it's called The Weinholds, at the YouTube channel. And so in the course of the next about 3 weeks, we'll have about 6 hours of of YouTube videos where people can see us in action, and we're talking about codependency and counterdependency and our new books, and so people can see us in action.
That sounds fantastic. Love YouTube. Also, tell me a little bit about the Institute. Are you guys training people to, training them in your work with how to deal with these issues, counterdependency and codependency? What's the Institute about?
This is the Carolina Institute for Conflict Resolution and Creative Leadership. It was founded in 1987, back when we lived in Colorado, and it's the vehicle that we've used for our professional work for quite a long time. When we taught at the University of Colorado in Colorado Springs, we did a lot of training there. We had a lot of students who went through our training programs, and since coming to Asheville, we don't do private work with people anymore. We don't do therapy, but we do coaching, and I work a lot with people in the child care professions, helping them head off some developmental trauma in these young children that they work with. And we also do training with a therapist here through our local Mountain Area Health Education Center. So we have a lot of trainings that are going on, and we present at local and regional conferences. So we're pretty active for people who are supposed to be retired. Retire means change tires and head in a new direction. That's what we've done.
I'm so glad you didn't hit Florida and start golfing and whatever.
We were tempted.
It's so necessary. So thank you so much for creating these amazing books with such beautiful insight and content in helping people identify and heal these developmental traumas that really have gone unnoticed for such a long time. It really is a major, major piece in helping women and men be empowered in their lives and have the relationships and love that they really want to have.
Well, it's been really great talking with you, Lisa. You are so right on and so sharp. I feel really hopeful that there's people like you out doing the kind of work that you're doing.
Yes, we're growing and we're finding each other. And I just want to say before we go that, listeners, remember you can email me at Alisa, A-L-I-S-S-A, at personallifemedia.com. I love your comments. You can ask any questions and offer ideas for topics you want to hear. And also, there's text and transcripts of this show and other shows on the Personal Life Media Network. Just go to personallifemedia.com. And don't forget, you can pick up a copy of my book, Four Cornerstones to Living Your Dreams, on Amazon.com. So, Janae, again, thank you so much. Maybe we'll have you back and talk about codependency next.
Well, that would be great. And we can also talk more about how to parent children. That's another great topic I love to talk on.
I love that. And also maybe get more into, you know, when you're already in a couple, you're already in a partnership, how to turn the boat around, maybe if your boat is heading down the river over the waterfall.
Well, that's something I've had some experience in.
Yay! I think that's a huge piece of this, is not being afraid to admit our foibles and our problems and, you know, the things that, you know, we might want to not share with the world, but it's time.
We're time. That's the counterdependent thing, is that we have these problems and we don't want anybody to know about it.
Yeah, exactly. Awesome. So, Janae, thanks so much for being on Just for Women. I'm going to go.
All right, dear. Well, thanks again. It was great.
Thanks so much. I'm your host, Alisa Kreitman, always expanding your choices here on Just for Women, Dating, Relationships, and Sex. Tune in next week for more juicy news you can use.
Find more great shows like this on personallifemedia.com.